It's Monday, July 10th, 2017. I'm Jeremiah Zimmerman, and this is episode 122 of the 5049 podcast. How you guys doing? You all right? Thank you for joining us for another conversation between myself and another musician. Today, that musician is a young clarinetist who, these days, when people ask me who I enjoy listening to, he's the guy that I recommend. Today on the show, John McCallum. Let's have a listen. In the world of clarinet improvisation, utilizing extended techniques, you know, there is a pretty finite amount of material to draw from, and I think John does it with an exceptional amount of individuality. He's a really great musician, and I'm really happy to have him on the show today. Today on the show, John McCallum. Before we get into it, I want to say thanks to everyone who has been checking in on the Patreon page, as well as rating, reviewing, and subscribing to it on iTunes. Believe it or not, that stuff really helps. The more people that become aware of the show through iTunes, the more visible it becomes, and I don't think I need to explain the snowball of that and how it's helpful. But if you've recently signed up to be a donor through Patreon, just know that I really appreciate it. It helps a lot. So John McCallum. John first came on my radar maybe 2 or 3 years ago. I don't remember how exactly. He plays in a band called Wei Zhongle, who I think I first became aware of. And Wei Zhongle, I don't know any other way to describe what they do other than, you know, it's utterly unique and really bizarre. But I think John might have sent me a message or an email to send me some of his solo stuff. And this was when he was at Mills doing a master's program. And it felt familiar to me in a way that I could hear the way he was playing, and it felt very much like someone who is cut from a similar cloth as me. And I mean that just beyond what he was doing musically. And over the years, you know, I see John when he comes to town. I ran into him when I was in Chicago back in May. And as I learned on the conversation today, we actually have a lot in common. You know, we're both self-taught musicians who, you know, have sort of figured out where we fit in through, I think, a lot of trial and error. Particularly, John tells a story on the show today about how he became involved with Roscoe Mitchell, the great Roscoe Mitchell, who teaches at Mills. John wrote a letter to Roscoe to get into the school. He didn't apply to the school. He wrote a letter to Roscoe to say, I think your work is amazing, it's important, and I want to study with you. It reminded me very much of when I was 13, and I really wanted to go to a specific summer camp, and I knew my family didn't have the money, so I sent a letter to the camp to broker a deal in which I would get a job, send the paychecks directly to the camp, And it worked. And in my life, I've written a lot of letters, and I think John has too. And something about it it really felt familiar to me. And I enjoyed today's conversation quite a lot. And this was just recorded a couple of weeks ago. John currently lives in Oakland, California, though he's originally from Carbondale, Illinois. For those of you unfamiliar with Carbondale, it's really much closer and much more part of the South than it is, you know, near Chicago or Milwaukee or anything. And I think it's a pretty unique place that puts out pretty unique people. If you want to find out more about John McCallum, and I really strongly suggest that you do, please go to johnmccallum.com. That's johnmccowen.com. He just put out a really beautiful recording of his clarinet quartet, and I really give it my highest recommendation. If you're looking for some new music that is interesting and being produced by a really special individual, I would strongly urge you to check it out. Go to johnmccallum.com. If you're enjoying this show, please rate and review it in iTunes, and please check out the Patreon. That's patreon.com/5049podcasts. That's it. Hope you guys are all doing well. Here's my conversation with John McCallum. We were semi-fucked by Spirit Airlines.
Absolutely.
Did you...
Oh, God.
What happened with you and Spirit Airlines? Were you able to navigate that and get on a different flight?
Well, what I did was I panicked. And I looked at their scheduling online, and they had canceled every flight from O'Hare to Oakland for the next 3 days.
Right.
And I was just like, well, fuck, there's no way I'm going to get on that flight. And then, you know, but the day that I was leaving, it said on time, you know, 3 days of cancellations and then on time.
But that's a lie.
Right. And but then, so I bought a ticket with United for like 110.
One way.
Yeah. And I was like, all right, I can make this work.
Yeah.
And then I did that and got an email from Spirit being like, you know, confirmation of, like, it ran. That was the first day it ran. So I bought two plane tickets and just didn't get on the Spirit flight.
But did you get the refund from Spirit?
No. I didn't think I could.
Yeah, you can. I got to...
But you got seriously fucked, though.
I got fucked. I got to the airport. I bought a separate ticket on JetBlue, got to the airport, went up to the fuck, because I also received a second confirmation. I got the confirmation from Spirit that my flight would be leaving out of Chicago fine, but I knew it wasn't.
Right.
And I went to the counter. There was literally a news crew at the counter interviewing customers who got screwed. I went right up to the lady. I was the only person who wasn't like screaming like, you fucking bitch, I'll kill you. I went up and I was like, hey, this really sucks. I just want to make sure that I'm... And she was super cool. I got my money back. But I think in general, like, it behooves a traveler to just not deal with, like, the $50, the $80 you save on a discount airline, you'll pay for it in other ways.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't ever think about it that way. I'm just like, all right, this is cheap.
Right. But so, like, today you have to go to Newark at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. But, you know.
But how much did you save on the ticket?
A lot. Because it wasn't as cheap as I thought it was going to be.
Right.
So I probably saved like $150.
Okay. Are you? But I feel like you do a lot of traveling.
These days, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Are you getting your wings? Like, are you kind of?
No, I hate it.
No, but I mean, like, are you learning like travel chops?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm just pretty like stubborn, so I just do it no matter what. I just see the end goal, and I'm like, oh, whatever. You know, I'll get there, and I'll get done with it, and then I'll get home. And then once I get home, I'll be like, wow, that was fucking crazy.
Yeah. But you, I mean, I feel like from when we talked on Skype like a year ago or whatever, you started touring in like Rockaway.
Yeah.
Of, you know, not expecting very much from travel accommodations or venues. That's
I guess that's what it comes down to, is being 18 years old and just like booking a your first tour and just being like, oh, this is how it goes,
right? I mean, most of my touring experience has been, you know, like crossing my fingers on the way from the shitty venue to the shitty place I'm staying that it won't be too bad. But it doesn't have to be that way,
right?
Have you experienced the other version of touring?
What do you mean, like, nice? No. Like, I had one tour. The really funny thing about it is that, so I used to be in this, like, stoner rock band in L.A. called Tweak Bird.
Yeah.
Which was, like, friends of mine I grew up with who moved to L.A. And then they were touring, and we played together. Uh-huh. And I was playing, like, tenor and soprano and flute at that point in time. And they were just like, shit, well, you should join the band. And so I started touring with them and going out to LA a lot. And I was like 21, 22 around that point in time. And then we played in LA, and I went back to Southern Illinois, and the drummer had moved back from LA to Southern Illinois. And he asked me to come over one night, and he was just like, hey, so what are you doing in a month? And I was like, I don't know, man. He's like, you want to open for Tool? And I was like, no fucking way. And he was like, yeah, we got asked to do their summer U.S. tour opening for them.
Right.
And I was like, okay. So flew out to L.A., rehearsed. But then the thing about the tour is that, you know, they're on, like, planes and buses.
Right.
Like, And so I figured we were getting those accommodations.
Oh, no, 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 no,
no.
No. No, no, no,
no. We were in our van.
That you supplied.
That we supplied.
And who was paying for the tolls and gas and everything?
That was us.
Uh-huh.
And so because they're in planes and buses and shit, like, what was it? First show was in Salt Lake City. Uh-huh. Second show was in Phoenix. Third show was in San Antonio. Like, these drives were brutal. And so what we would do was, as soon as the gig was over, like, we would have to, like, honk our van through crowds of Tool fans leaving the show to get out to just start driving.
To just put your fucking foot to the pedal to the floor,
yeah,
and try to get there in time for the next sound check.
No, well, what we would do was we would sleep in Walmart parking lots.
Those are known to be the safest place to sleep.
Yeah. So we would sleep in a Walmart parking lot, and because it was the middle of summer in, like, the Southwest, as soon as the sun came up, it was just
brutally,
like,
hot.
Whoever woke up first, just roll down the windows and start driving and let everybody else sleep. And then hopefully it was actually a pretty good method. Like, we'd start driving and you'd feel the air and you'd be like, okay, we're moving. And then once somebody woke up, you're just like, hey, I'll take over.
How long was the tour?
2 months.
You lived like that for 2 months?
Yeah.
And at any point in those 2 months, did the guys from Tool be like, hey, there's an extra room you guys can...
No. I mean, they were really nice.
Yeah, I've heard those guys are really nice.
Like, not, like, all but one, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I think I know which
one. Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was funny. I didn't have any interaction with Maynard, but...
But Danny Carrier and Adam Jones are here, like,
oh,
great
guys.
Oh,
my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, one night I talked about, like, Alice Coltrane with Danny Carrier for, like, 2 hours.
Yeah.
And it led into, like, him having this, like, tabla teacher. And what was it? He was telling me about how he looked up to the drummer from Red Hot Chili Peppers because he was, like, had his life together and he was straight and, like...
Chad Smith?
Yeah. He was, like, running every day.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, so I'm just trying to play tabla and, like, start running.
Yeah.
And so he's telling me, like, oh, man, I gotta burn a CD for you, man. I gotta play some shit for you. I'm like, okay, you know, I'll never hear this, whatever.
Right.
And then I was coming off stage the next day in Cincinnati, I think. And Danny's just standing right at the side of the stage.
With the CDR.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, man, I told you I was gonna burn you this shit. And then I remember I forgot about it and got home and put it in my CD player. And it was just a shit ton of 80s Michael Brecker.
What?
No shit. And I was just, I just laughed for a while. I was like, yeah, this is dope. I mean,
it's cool.
It wasn't what I was expecting.
I have a lot of friends who have done those exposure tours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they go on tour opening for a band, like, under, like, the most, like, abject, worst touring conditions. Meanwhile, the other band is having a pretty nice time, seemingly.
And their whole crew.
Uh-huh, and their whole crew. The crew for that band is sleeping, eating, and living better, and probably earning more,
mm-hmm,
than the opening band.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking shit about bands right now, but I always wonder, like, at some point, like, does Danny Carey or someone not be like, hey, you know, thanks for doing this. Here's a surprise hotel room or something.
Yeah, I don't know, because I was so young and so eager. Like,
uh-huh,
I was still living, like, a half hour from where I was raised.
Right.
You know, at that point in time, I had a house to myself.
Yeah.
Like, one of those backyard little houses.
Sure.
And I was just like, I got it made, you know? And...
Not paying rent, going on tour with Tool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, well, I mean, I actually didn't really make that much money from that tour.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I paid a month's rent in Carbondale, Illinois,
right,
which was $350. And I bought a piano off Craigslist because I was so fucking stupid. It's just like, all right, I got a piano. And yeah, but I don't know.
So wait, Carbondale, Illinois, and I don't think I realized this until recently, like, Northern Illinois and Southern Illinois are two very different places.
Very different places.
Like, very different places.
Yeah.
Like, Carbondale doesn't have a whole lot to do with Chicago, does it?
Hell no.
Carbondale's the South.
Yeah, kind of.
It gets closer to Tennessee and Kentucky than Chicago or Milwaukee.
Yeah, like my mom lives in Nashville, Tennessee, and from Carbondale, it would take me 3 hours to get to Nashville, and it would take me 5.5, 6 to get to Chicago.
Culturally, across the board, Nashville and Chicago are very different places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have a preference for one over the other?
I mean, they're very different, but I like them both. I mean, there's not as much room for me in Nashville doing what I do.
Right.
But there is some really weird shit going on in Nashville.
Like what?
Like, there's this one group called the Cherry Blossoms that Wayzongle has played with a number of times. And they're like free folk. You know,
that's cool.
Yeah.
That sounds cool.
It's like this older woman, Peggy, who has a dog with her.
On stage?
Yeah, well, I mean, she shows up and she's like, oh, hi. And she's like, do you guys need any weed? Yeah. And, but then she just kind of gets on stage and plays her songs, and her band is just like free jazz dudes. And they're just like playing free behind it.
Right.
And she's just playing her songs, and it's really fucked up and awesome.
Uh-huh.
And then there's also the more rock side of things with Nashville.
Yeah.
Like, there's groups like Narwhal, and my brother was in a group. My brother used to live in Nashville, and he was in, like a rock band called Turbo Fruits.
Uh-huh.
Which is, like, they did, like, one of those Vice cruise ship tours, you know, that kind of shit.
I lived in Nashville for almost a year.
No shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I hated it while I was there, but this was a long time ago. This is like 2001.
Yeah.
I met some cool people. I had a lot of fun. I raised a lot of hell. I drank a lot.
Yeah.
I've got to hang out in some pretty cool studios, but I didn't find any kindred spirits in terms of like improvising or being interested in like 20th century composition or anything like
that. Right.
None.
Yeah.
Wait, so I know we talked about this before, but you didn't start on clarinet.
No.
You started on
saxophone.
Okay, so you've always been a woodwind player.
Well, I mean, I was a vocalist in like hardcore and punk bands.
Yeah.
And then that led to saxophone.
Right.
Because like in Southern Illinois, what was really good about Southern Illinois was there was little towns around Carbondale, and so Carbondale has this house called Lost Cross, which is one of the oldest running or longest running punk houses in the nation. It's been open since 86.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's stories of like Black Flag and all these bands that played there. And so the surrounding towns with all the teenagers and shit, we knew about it and we kind of had our own little scenes. And the town I was in, we were a little weirder. And so it started with like the town next to us, all the kids were into the Ramones and they like wanted to sniff glue and shit. And we wanted nothing to do with the Ramones. Like none of us liked that shit.
Mm-hmm.
We were all about Black Flag and Bad Brains and then Black Sabbath. And then from Black Sabbath, that led to like, you know, through a bunch of different ways, we got to Zappa and Zappa led to Sun Ra and, you know,
and once you're there,
just went on and on. And so I got to the point where the band I was in, I integrated playing saxophone into it because we toured a few times and my throat, like I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. So I would like have trouble breathing after sets and stuff.
Right.
And so
you weren't treating your throat like an instrument?
No.
Yeah.
And because I didn't know how, you know, you're just like, this is what you do. You go on stage, you scream your brains out and then you walk off and everybody does it. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but around that time I heard Albert Eiler, and that's when I went like 90 degrees.
Yeah.
I heard Truth Is Marching In from Live in Greenwich Village, and I didn't know what the fuck
that
was.
That's still my favorite Eiler piece of all time.
Yeah, that's my favorite piece of all time.
Yeah. It literally got everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that recording with the violin, like, it's the greatest thing ever.
Absolutely. And, I heard it at my friend's house, and I had no idea what it was. I didn't know if it was, like, a New Orleans funeral march. I didn't know if it was, like, some, like, Fugs era kind of, like, fucked up free folk kind of thing. Or I just had no context for it. And then I figured it out, And when I realized it was a saxophone doing that shit, I was like,
"Wait, you couldn't hear that it was a tenor?"
No, not really. I was that ignorant. Like, I went and I heard that, and I was like, "Fuck, I'm gonna need a saxophone." And I bought an alto, and then I bought that alto, and then saw pictures of Albert Eiler and was like, "Wait,
he's playing a tenor."
Shit.
But you know, he plays alto on Bells.
Yeah.
Wait. But did so you bought an alto? Was it like one of those Yamaha?
It was from like a band shop.
It's a piece of shit.
Yeah, piece of shit. But I didn't know it.
No, I know. It's funny because that's very similar. I feel like a shitty alto sax is like way shittier than the shitty version of other instruments. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can play a shitty guitar and make some stuff happen.
Yeah.
A shitty alto really sounds bad.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Because I bought another one like a year and a half ago. And just had it for like a month.
Uh-huh.
And was just like, fuck this, I can't do this.
What was it? The one you bought a year and a half ago. Was it like a decent horn?
It was a like low-level con
right.
or something. And I thought it was going to be cool, but then it really wasn't. And it just made me want to play clarinet more.
Yeah. You know what? I just want to say for a second, like, I hate bad instruments.
That's a great stance to have.
I would rather have one really solid instrument and just have that one instrument than have a bunch of junk. And like, I get caught on eBay. Like, I get caught slipping all the time. I go on eBay and I'm like drinking and I'm like, oh, dude, I'll buy a $1,500 bass clarinet.
Right.
And thankfully, like, I slap myself and I'm like, no, I don't deserve a bass clarinet. You
know, these Chinese bass clarinets can't be that bad. Bakelite, what's that? That's gonna be all right.
All right, so you heard The Truth Is Marching In, and you bought an alto, and you're like, oh, why doesn't it sound like that?
Right. But I didn't realize it because I was coming from, like, punk music, so I just went as hard as I could.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it didn't work because I've heard recordings of myself from back then, and you know, I go for it really hard, and then the air just, like, cuts off.
Just, and like, it's biting the reed. And,
yeah. Not even, like, good biting the reed. It's
right.
just, like, it sounds like somebody learning to play the instrument with a lot of energy with a punk band behind them.
Were there any musical ideas there, or was it just a lot of like working your middle finger trill a lot?
I wasn't really doing that. Uh-huh. I was more at that point in time, I think, like, I really liked, when it comes to the sound of a saxophone, like, Pharoah Sanders is like that scream, his signature, like
tenor.
Not that like, but that thing that he can just get going for a while.
Like, it sounds like pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, what are you talking about?
That was like, that's my shit.
Yeah.
So that's what I was going for. It was never really like just doing this with a palm key. And, but yeah, it was bad. And I think at one point when we went on tour, I learned like the lick from Black Dog, like Led Zeppelin on it. So we would end the set and I would play it in unison with the guitar player.
Did it sound cool?
I doubt it. I mean, it was just like, oh, this would be fucking funny, you know?
Right.
So.
But, I mean, I feel like you and I found our way to the clarinet in what I think is a very similar way. Mm-hmm. And it's more common now that there are people like that. And I find that, like, the point where things change is when you begin to take music seriously in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually look at like what you know, what, whether it's the clarinet and how you approach, you know, intonation and your embouchure and everything else, or looking at structures and improvising, looking at, you know, what makes a composition. This is, you know, this is where you either, I don't know how I can say this without sounding like a jerk, but either stay, you know, in that starting point or actually begin to evolve.
Yeah.
When did you, you know, kind of start looking at the clarinet as, or when did you make the switch to clarinet?
It was like, so I'd been touring with that band Tweakbird for a while, and like we went to Europe and did some stuff.
Uh-huh.
So we went to Europe and had like a really great tour, like fucking sold out venues in Ljubljana, Slovenia.
You guys were the headliner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was just like, holy shit. Like, you know, those two guys would like play for a while, and then I'd walk out on stage with a tenor, and people like wanted to hear it. And I was like, oh my God, this is great. So then we come back to the States and do a US tour where we're the headliners, and we're playing like it's like a punk tour. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're playing like Storage Units in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And that's when it all kind of started to really settle in for me that like, this is just a cycle. This is just going to like, it's not really going to get any better than this. You know, we had those shows in Europe because all the flyers, whatever language it was, the one word you could read was Tool at the bottom of it, you know, because we had just done that US tour with them. Mm-hmm. And so I realized, I was like, man, I can't just fucking play in A minor every night. And I was reading a lot on those tours. And one of the books I read was around that time I heard like some piece by John Adams. Mm-hmm. And with the timbres and the instruments and shit like that, you know, when you're getting into instruments, you don't know what all the instruments are. You know, I didn't grow up in a band program or anything like that. And so you hear like bass clarinets and marimbas and all that stuff. You're like, oh, like Zappa used that one, or, you know, you have no context. And so I remember reading that book and like, oh, I read Hallelujah Junction. That like, it's John Adams's like autobiography. It's really pretentious. He like slips in and out of like, I got pissed like trying to read it because he slips in and out of like French phrases and all this stuff because he's a very worldly man.
Sure.
And, but at the time, it was just like me trying to get information. And so he was talking about writing some piece that involved like a marimba or something like that. And I was like, fuck, how am I going to write music for a marimba? None of my friends have marimbas. And that's when I started to realize, oh, that's why you go to music school. Uh-huh. And so I quit Tweakbird and moved back to my house in Southern Illinois and started going to a community college for music.
For composition or for performance?
It was a community college. You just take like music classes.
So you're literally like, this is a whole note, this is a half note.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was just like, it was just a large chunk of extremely humbling experiences where they like tried to put me in choir and I was like, no, I really don't want to do that. Like, and the teacher was this old woman who was very, she like said some shit one day where it was like anything after the romantic period was strictly for like show musically. And I remember her saying that of being like, what the fuck?
Right.
And me being like, what about like the last movement of Stravinsky's Firebird, that like French horn solo? That's romantic as fuck. It's totally beautiful. Yeah. But I didn't say it like that to her. And she was just like, you know, you just couldn't break her. Uh-huh. So I just kept my mouth shut.
Yeah.
Learned my counterpoint.
Yeah.
And got through it. And then it got to a point where they're like, okay, you have to have by that point, I was playing with my friend. You know, I was involved in other bands, like prog rock bands and shit like that, because I was playing horns in Southern Illinois. And my friend Rob Jacobs moved there, who I'm still in Wayzongle with.
Uh-huh.
And he needed a horn player, because he would like write songs and he would just multi-track everything himself. So by that point, I had heard Eric Dolphy. I had gotten a bass clarinet.
Uh-huh.
And I was playing bass clarinet by that point, too. And I was loving bass clarinet.
Yeah, it's such a great instrument.
Yeah. The embouchure was just kind of like, didn't really need much until I got in the high range. And it worked out. And so I was thinking I could go to music school for bass clarinet.
Okay.
Like, just play bass clarinet. Because I was getting over the saxophone by that point. I was like, I just can't do it. And so it came point where they were like, you have to take applied lessons now.
Applied lessons?
Yeah, like at the community college. Uh-huh. Like, you either have to be in choir or you have to be taking instrumental lessons or, you know, something like that. And so I had a friend who was a saxophone player who had gone through the jazz program at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. And he taught me a lot. He was like, he knew that I really didn't know much, and he would show me like whole tone scales and diminished scales and just be like, that's the shit you probably need to know.
I'm right.
Like, okay. And he was like, well, have you ever heard of Eric Mandat? I'm like, no, who's that? Because I was so ignorant at that point. I thought because I had gone on tour with Tool, I could get into like a really good music school.
Oh, you thought you'd put that on your application?
Yeah, and just like get in like somewhere in New England or something like that. And but I couldn't read music.
It's an issue.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was slowly settling in that I was going to have to go to the college like 20 minutes away from me. And he was like, well, have you ever heard of Eric Mandat? He's the clarinet professor at SIU. I'm like, no, I don't know who this guy is. And he played me a shit. And I mean, this is the guy who did the most work besides Bill Smith when it comes to multiphonics. And he came up with like the quarter tone fingering charts. And I mean, super far out. Yeah, he's in the Rehfeld.
Right, he's in the Rehfeld. But someone just gave me a copy of these fingering charts that I think are his.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's written some of the most far out music for like, you know, solo clarinet and clarinet ensembles. And so I heard this shit and I was like, oh my God, okay. And so when they told me I had to take applied lessons, I said, I want to study with Eric Mandat. And I remember the band director or the choir director at this community college was just like, you know, he's a genius. And like they wanted to have me with like a band director from a small town.
They didn't think you deserved to study with someone who knew what they were doing.
Right. And I was like, well, okay. And so I contacted him personally.
Yeah.
And we arranged this audition where I came to his office.
You showed up just with the B-flat clarinet?
No, bass clarinet.
Right.
And so by that point, the instrument had broken. Like it was a plastic, like Vito bass clarinet. And it had broken at the middle because I'd been playing it in basements and then taking it outside in the summer and stuff. And so I went to my dad's auto shop and used like auto epoxy.
Are you kidding me?
To put it back together. And then when it was on the stand in my room, it had fallen over and broken the tip of the mouthpiece.
Oh, geez.
And so I used a hot glue gun to put that back together. And it still played. And so, and then I also came up with this stupid thing where I used sandpaper on the keys so I had more grip. And I show up to Eric Mandat's office and I play for a little while. And I had spent like, I knew this was coming. So I had spent a few months like practicing scales and stuff. And I remember in the lesson, he just laughed at me. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not getting in. He's not going to take me on as a student. And at the end, he's just like, yeah, let's do this. And later he told me that he was like, that was a really fucked up thing that happened. I mean, he told me that I had came up with my own fingerings for notes, and he was just like, it's like, yeah, you obviously had drive and creativity, but you didn't know what the hell you were doing.
Right.
So
did he comment on this like junk house horn you had?
Yeah. He thought it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so he hooked me up with a nice buffet bass clarinet through the music or through SIU.
Like as long as you're in school, you can play this horn.
Yeah. And so all of a sudden I had like a really, really nice bass clarinet. It was low E flat. It wasn't low C, but it was still like
low C. Fuck that.
Yeah. It was like wood and had all the gold inlay on it. I'm just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And, so when I started studying with him, he got me into the music school at SIU, like, because he had been there for like 35 years at that point in time. Somehow he got me in under the audition. Like,
you didn't have to do an audition.
Right. He just kind of somehow passed me under that because I wouldn't have been able to do anything.
And had you done an audition, do you think you would not have gotten in?
Oh yeah. I didn't know what I was doing.
I
would have done some improvisation.
Right. But so then, okay. So he gets you in, but then what happens when you have to show up to an ensemble class? What happens?
So, I mean, I went there, I started as music composition. And as I went longer into it, it kind of became this dual music composition clarinet performance thing. And so I was writing music for like bass clarinet duo. Like I would record myself on my computer and then multi-track it. And then I would play it for him and he would notate it for me what I was doing. And he would be like, see, this is like, you know, this rhythm and this is what this notes and... I had a basic knowledge at that point in time, but I wasn't like reading.
You know?
And that's just how we started out. And he showed me the fucked up shit he knew how to do with a clarinet. And I was like, oh, I want to do that. So,
right. So it started out, you would put your ideas into a recording
mm-hmm.
and then he would show you what they look like as written ideas.
Yeah.
That had to have been helpful.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, I owe everything to this man.
Yeah. Does that, did you begin to see that compositionally, once the ideas were on paper, that there's like certain things you just like were doing over and over again, or you, were you able to kind of get an idea of what your inclinations were?
Yeah, I mean, like large leaps of eighth notes, because I like Derek Dolphy.
Yeah.
But also like Stravinsky and Carl Stalling.
Yeah.
You know, like grew up, I wanted to be a cartoonist as a kid, so I just watched Looney Tunes on loop as a kid. So that Carl Stalling bass clarinet shit, I think, got in my head at a young age. So
what happened when you finished school and you had to give the horn back?
Well, I mean, I was there for a while, and the thing that he did was, as soon as he let me in, he goes, "So you can't just play bass clarinet anymore. You have to learn B flat." And I hated B flat clarinet.
Because it was what?
Hard.
Why? What's hard about the B flat clarinet?
When you come from a saxophone, it's hard.
Describe that.
Difference in embouchure, and actually having to put your fingers in exact spots as opposed to like slap them down, because you know that's going to close the shit off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, getting that muscle memory of like, if you're moving a scale or something like that, you got to know exactly where that finger is going.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I hear people say that all the time, that clarinet's so hard coming from sax.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just always think of it as being the other way.
Yeah.
So his idea that you had to play B flat was, you're not a real clarinetist unless you play B flat, or what?
No, because I had to like be in ensembles and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And so he threw me in the civic orchestra, which was like the community orchestra that you could pass as like a credit. And so I was second chair to this 15-year-old who had been studying with Mandat like all his life. And it was probably one of the most humbling experiences of my life, where this 15-year-old is looking over at me, and I'm like 23, and he's looking at me like, I'm fucking crazy, because I don't know what I'm doing at all. And he's like, got his shit down.
Was he like condescending to you? Or
Hell yeah.
Fucking 15-year-old.
Yeah, and I just let it happen. I was like, I'm not about to like snark back at this kid. Like, I'll just let him do his thing, because I'm here to learn music. And I was very like focused at that point in time.
Yeah, that's good. A lot of people would have either like just slipped out and been like, fuck this, or, you know.
Because I didn't want to do anything else. So I had to like stay the course. I was like, I have to get through this.
So, but it's good for you. Like, if you can have that kind of approach, like you can just know, like, just I'm just going to eat crow and, you know, I need to do this. Like, it's good that a 15-year-old made you feel bad.
Yeah. He like, sucked.
Really?
No, I mean, he was a good clarinet player, but yeah, he was an asshole.
Yeah. But I mean, if you're gonna like humble yourself and eat crow, it's better that a 15-year-old was rude to you than like a master was nice to you.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe not.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you had both. A master that was being nice and a 15-year-old.
Yeah, but I mean, when I wasn't practicing, Mandat would let me know, you know.
He would say, look, I can hear that you didn't play for 2 days.
Right. I mean, it was rare that I didn't play for 2 days, but like, if he told me, okay, I have to go home and learn this etude, and I fucking hated that etude, which was like, you know, a page of 16th notes that I couldn't play and I couldn't articulate, I would just like not practice it. And then I'd come to his office, and he'd just be like pissed, you know.
Why are you wasting my time?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
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 But it just kept evolving from there, and I figured out how to play the instrument, and I moved my way up in the college and was actually kind of knew what I was doing when I got that degree.
And at some point, you began to enjoy playing B-flat more than bass, or you just had to give the bass back, so you said, fuck it, I'll play B-flat.
Well, I had access to that contrabass clarinet that the music school had, because nobody touched that thing. It was just like sitting there.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is even lower. So I fell in love with that instrument. But then the B-flat had its own characteristics, you know, that I really liked. Like, I was figuring out, you know, Mandat was showing me multiphonics and all this stuff, and I was like, oh my God, wow, this is really cool. Like, to me, it was so much more dynamic than, like, doing multiphonics on the saxophone, that I just, it kept drawing me in.
Yeah.
So I just kept doing it. And yeah, just always since then, it's been B flat and contrabass clarinet.
Yeah. And so there's no bass clarinet in your life anymore.
Yeah, I can't afford one.
Right. Doesn't that suck? Like, you, a bass clarinet, you either. I guess you could get like a used buffet 1180 for like $4,000 or $5,000. Mm-hmm. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's not in the cards.
It's not in the cards, but that's as close as you're going to get to. Like, there aren't any mid range horns in the bass clarinet.
It's true.
There's not. And I mean, like, a real horn. Like, you can get. Like, I don't want to pay $3,000 for a plastic horn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to pay $4,000 for a plastic horn. Out of your mind? But yeah. It's either like you're either paying $1,500, $1,800 for a plastic horn, or you're paying $11,000 for a real horn.
Yeah. Or you get lucky on eBay and you find like a wooden noble that's low E flat that's like kind of nice.
Yeah, but like, I mean, honestly, buying, you shouldn't. I feel like you can buy an R13 online and you pretty reliably are going to know what you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, if you're buying horns or mouthpieces, like, you really got to play them.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to pay $5,000 for a horn that I haven't played.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Anyway, all right, so when you finished there, did you immediately apply to Mills?
Yeah.
Why did you apply to Mills?
Because I wanted to get the fuck out of Southern Illinois.
Primarily, you wanted to get out of Southern Illinois?
Yeah.
That was above who was actually at Mills or what?
Well, no. So the great thing about Eric Manda, I mean, I can just spend hours praising that man. But so he brought clarinet players to SIU.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much seemingly specifically for me.
What do you mean?
There wasn't really other people into... Like, he brought Francois Uhl there.
Uh-huh.
And he brought James Falzone there.
Oh, wow.
And then he also brought Chris Corsano and Gino Robert.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, because we had an improv ensemble, too.
Uh-huh.
And it was him and Ron Coulter, the percussion professor, were the two guys that were pushing this stuff.
Uh-huh.
And... So it was just opening me up to stuff. And I was working on my solo thing at that point in time, like the circular breathing and all that stuff, because I had friends that played guitar with pedals and they could sustain shit for a really long
period
of time.
But had you heard stuff like Evan and Parker?
No.
Okay.
I had heard Roscoe.
Okay.
So the first thing I learned on alto saxophone when I got it was like an Art Ensemble of Chicago track with Fontella bass.
Uh-huh.
I figured out this like Roscoe, like just kind of funk line that was pretty easy. And I was like, oh, this is saxophone when I was just starting out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I kind of stuck with Art Ensemble of Chicago and seeing what Roscoe was doing. And then I figure out, you know, it leads me to his solo stuff. Francois Uhl was the guy that introduced me to Evan Parker because mm-hmm. he studied with him for a while.
Really?
So, yeah. So Francois did a solo concert at SIU.
Okay.
And it made me cry because what I was doing was connected with what he was doing.
What year was this?
Oh, shit.
Was he doing the stuff with the piano where he would put like a brick on
2013?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, he's been doing that for a while. But, yeah.
And so I went up to him after the concert and I was like, dude, I have to come to Vancouver. Like, I have to come and study with you. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to do this. And he was just like, well, you need to listen to Evan Parker. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay. And he told me something that has stuck with me for a long time. He said that Evan had told him at one point in time that if you get into this hard enough, you can stand in front of yourself and listen to yourself play. He told me that mm-hmm. Evan had said something like,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I when I interviewed Evan,
mm-hmm.
he just kind of laughed it off and he was like, well, I don't really remember that. And but that stuck with me. I was like, oh, holy shit.
Right.
And, and Bill Smith had came there and I worked with him.
Wow.
Yeah. I played his Epitaphs for double clarinet and I got to like just spend a day just me and him working on that.
Oh man, I would kill for that opportunity. Yeah.
It was great. I mean, Eric just hooked it up just over and over
I mean, heavy, heavy, heavies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was also doing a lot of free improv at that point in time in like basements in Carbondale.
So with the clarinet.
Yeah. So I had like my dual world going on.
Well, the clarinet is like, my experience with the clarinet is when it comes to like free improvised music, like I have to be kind of careful in who I play with for it to be a good musical experience, because the instrument itself, like, it asks a certain level of sensitivity from other musicians. Like, if it's not, if everyone's playing over the top, there's only so much you can do with a clarinet.
You end up in,
yeah, it sucks. And it's annoying to listen to.
You're stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I had the school's contrabass clarinet at that point in time. And then I was slowly leaving the saxophones. I was still kind of playing, like...
Did anyone tell you, hey, man, just forget about the sax?
No. Like, Mandat was encouraging. He was like, I quit playing saxophone a long time ago. I think you should keep playing it. But the more and more I got into it, the more and more I was just like, yeah, there's so many people doing this better than me that I'm just going to leave it behind. But at that point in time, when I was improvising, I was mainly playing contrabass, clarinet, and soprano sax.
Mm-hmm. So. Do you know that Bill Smith record, Folk Jazz?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, like Green Sleeves and shit on,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
It's like the best clarinet record ever.
Yeah,
it's best clarinet good. Jazz. I mean, I'm surprised how many people don't know that record. Yeah. I've listened to that thing probably 300, 400 times.
Well, it's hard to find Bill's stuff.
Yeah, well, but that record, you can get it on iTunes. You can get it on Amazon. It's there.
Oh, okay.
I tell people, you know how many people I turned, I'm telling you literally right now, I turned Evan Parker onto that record. I turned Ken Vandermark onto that record. Like, yeah. People don't know this fucking record.
Yeah. And Bill's still playing. He's like,
he sounds amazing.
He's like 90 or 93 and he's still playing.
And he sounds really good.
Yeah.
With the damn clarinet.
Mm-hmm. Like, I saw him play at a winery when he was in Southern Illinois. Like, they had him, like,
there's a video of that on YouTube, I think.
Probably, yeah.
It's him and a bass clarinetist, right?
No, not that one.
Okay.
He was like with the faculty jazz combo.
Yeah.
And he just, like, I drove out to the middle of nowhere to this winery and he just tore it up. And working with him was just great.
So. Yeah. Did, do you stay in touch with Manda?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sounds like he shaped your life pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, like, I brought him out to Mills and introduced Roscoe to Mandat's music. And, like, I can't go a couple days without Roscoe being like, when's Mandat coming back out here? Like,
yeah.
I've heard him tell other people, like, John's teacher can do anything. And I'm like, well, thanks, dude. You know, Eric's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, we stay in touch. He lets me know what he's up to. And
so did you go to Mills to study with Roscoe specifically?
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you write to Roscoe or did you write to Mills?
I wrote to Roscoe.
See, that's smart.
Yeah. I wrote him this really long email just like, because I knew how much a private school cost. And I was like, I don't have this money.
You're talking about Mills specifically.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just like, fuck it. I'm going to go into debt. Everybody's in debt. This is what I have to do.
Yeah.
And so I wrote to Roscoe. And was like, I need to know if you're going on sabbatical. I need to know what you're doing. Because I'm coming here to study with you. So I want you here.
I don't want to go through all this bullshit and then not be able to actually study.
Yeah, and you're like on tour for like half the year.
Right.
But you come in and say hi in your classes. And he wrote me back. Well, first I sent him my first solo record. And he was like, just sent me an email saying, looking forward to working with you.
Oh, man.
And I was like, I guess that's good.
Yeah.
Well, he wrote back, and then to that long email I wrote after he sent me that one, he just said, "Dear John, thanks for your email. Looking forward to it." But then Mills flew me out there to see their like thesis festival.
Wait, what do you mean? You had applied to Mills,
and they took me on as a prospective student, and they fly like a small amount of students.
They pay for it.
Yeah. To come to Mills to experience it for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there for a day.
Okay.
Because I had like to be back for a tour.
Mm-hmm.
And my main goal was to find Roscoe. And I didn't see him around. Like, I think I had met Fred and some people.
Fred Frith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but then other students were like, oh, you're not going to see Roscoe. Like, you rarely see him. I was like, fuck. And I remember as soon as I'd had breakfast with some students that were like, oh, you're not going to see him.
Like, he's just not around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was walking back towards the music building, and here's this guy just walking towards me on the sidewalk in his, like, really nice clothes.
Yep.
And I stop, and I'm like, hey, I'm John McCown. He's like, Oh, Carbondale. I've been to Carbondale. And he just goes on about Southern Illinois for a while.
Yeah.
And he was just like, yeah, man, this is going to be great. Come on. And ever since then.
And there was, but you still didn't get any confirmation from him about how much he'd be around.
No. I mean, he said he'd be around.
Yeah.
And luckily, I went in a point in time where he was there consistently. And now, you know, they're trying to get rid of him.
Yeah. I've heard whisperings or shoutings of that.
Yeah. The final decision is going to happen tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah.
And I don't know. Should we talk about that or should we not talk about that?
He's fine with it either way. I mean, I'm not saying like talking about it. He's just, I'll say that if they keep him, they keep him. If they let him go, they let him go, because he's extremely prolific at this point in time. So
yeah, he's Roscoe Mitchell.
Yeah, he doesn't really mind.
Right. But it seems like, from what I can tell, at least through like social media, the people on faculty at Mills have all come together and said, hey, this is absurd that you would even consider this.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, he's huge there.
He's Roscoe Mitchell.
Exactly.
I mean, he's huge to the world of sound.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I've just spent the past 3 years hanging out with him. And because I wrote to him specifically, like demanding his time,
yeah,
it's like that sunk in with him. And he's just like, we play together still to this day, like from the time I showed up to Mills to now. It's like I get my weekly lesson in playing with Roscoe.
So. Yeah. I've heard from many people that Roscoe always tells people, don't follow me. Like, if you're improvising, like, don't do
it. Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He was like, that's a cop-out. Like, you're not using your own ideas. Like, following people is the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
He's like, we're doing, you know, he believes composition and improvisation are the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Like, at that point, you're doing variations or counterpoint.
Right.
You know, like, Bach didn't write unison lines for pages.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's his whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, you're making fucking music.
Right.
Like your Bach.
Right. Did, and what was it like moving to Oakland for you?
It was heavy. I mean, you know, I'm country boy, so, but I had toured, but it was fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you find, people to play with pretty quickly there? Do you feel like it's,
Yeah. Like, James Falzone was like, find Kyle Bruckman.
Yeah, Kyle's deep.
Yeah. And so I found Kyle. And, like, one of the first days I was there, I went to a show where it was, like, Kyle was playing, Tom Dill, and, some other people. And I just went up to Tom after the set and was like, hey, I just moved here. And he's like, oh, there's a session tomorrow. You want to come?
Uh-huh.
And I show up to the session, which was supposed to be this, like, a bunch of dancers and a bunch of musicians, and it was just me, Tom Dill, and Jacob Felix Huell.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, those are the two guys I play with the most consistently.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I owe a lot to those guys. They were just like, from then on out, it's just been like, I hit them up and we play.
You guys play a lot of gigs out there?
Yeah.
And what's the gigging scene like in San Francisco, or in Oakland?
There's a few, like, gallery spaces that have like a weekly residency of improv nights.
Uh-huh.
And so you hit up the people that run them and they send you the calendar with openings. And so if you like get together and rehearse with people, say like, oh, well, let's play over at Studio Grand next month.
Yeah.
And then you just fill it out.
Huh.
Yeah.
I've never played in California before. I've never played a gig in California.
I mean, the audiences are small, but it's kind of, that's improv for you.
Right. I see a lot of people from the Bay Area coming this way.
Mm-hmm.
Leaving the Bay Area, as it were.
Yeah.
Are you still thinking about moving?
Yeah, I'm going to leave. I can't stay there.
You can't stay there.
Yeah. I mean, because California is so beautiful.
Right.
It's like you're going to get, but there's not enough going on. You know?
Right.
It's like my interest is going to switch from music to having to have like a serious job. And I figured that'll lead to me like being really into my yard or something like that. You know, like,
right.
It'll go from music to like gardening or something.
Gardening's beautiful though.
It is, but I like music too.
So yeah. No, I like music better than gardening, but
yeah, I got to keep going.
So you're afraid to stay in California or hesitant to stay in California because it's such an easy place to be?
I mean, it's easy on the eyes for the most part. Everywhere else, it's hard. I mean, it's super expensive.
Right.
I have like a really sweet deal going on.
Through Mills?
No. Okay. I live with my partner. I never lived at Mills College.
Right.
When I first moved out there, I have a stepsister that lives out there, and she let me rent a room. And then she quickly kicked me out.
Yeah. Too much clarinet.
No, I wasn't even practicing there.
Right.
Because she lived really... It was like this thing that worked out where my stepsister was living really close to Mills College because she had just gotten divorced. So she had... And she was living up in like Sebastopol, which is like this really beautiful town.
Yeah, it's like Napa Valley. Or yeah. Sonoma, right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And she got divorced and, you know, it was bad. So the only thing she could afford was a house in East Oakland. Uh-huh. So she was just pissed all the time. Eesh. And here I am moving to Oakland, like bright-eyed, spending time with Roscoe. And I'm just playing avant-garde music. And so she hated it. And she was like, you got to get the fuck out of here.
Jesus Christ.
So I'd made friends by that point in time and found a room in West Oakland. And
yeah.
Then, yeah. So now I live with my partner. And
so do you know where you're going to move?
I don't know. I mean, my partner's from Iceland.
Yeah.
So... Now it's like, you know, we don't, I mean, it's going to be, we're thinking about East Coast, like New York is a possibility,
yeah,
but also Reykjavik's a possibility. So
yeah,
it's pretty much between those two right now.
Yeah. Last time I saw you like a month or two ago, that was the case,
but we haven't really figured much out. It's like we talk about it and both of us just end up like, ah, fuck, you know?
Right.
Because of, you know, money.
Yeah. I mean, so you're all wrapped up at Mills. You don't have any. You've defended.
I've been done there like a year and a half.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But I just live out there because I'm touring a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't really had the time to leave or move anywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, we've emailed a bit about this, but like, you know, now that you've been, you know, releasing your own music, what's that been like for you?
What do you mean? Just like releasing my own stuff?
Yeah. Like I feel like, I mean, I guess the only stuff of yours I've really heard are like the clarinet quartets and the solo stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a really specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been able to birth it into the world without too much pain?
I mean, I haven't gotten any reviews or anything really, because when you're self-releasing stuff and you... For me, at least, you like put it on Bandcamp and forget about it, you know?
Yeah. It's
like, that was my first lessons. Like, that's just, you're sending it out into the ether and nobody's going to see it.
But did you send it to people to review?
No.
Okay.
But now it's like, you know, I'm sitting on two solo records right now.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out how to get them out. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. It's tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Two full-length solo records.
Recorded, mixed, done, everything.
Well, one of them, I'm getting ready to go to Portland in like a week to mix it with my friend.
Okay.
And so then that one will be done.
Yeah. And then I imagine that solo is going to be something you continue to do for...
Oh, I fucking love it.
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Playing by yourself is so easy.
It's funny. I would say the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I like playing with people. But you can rehearse solo anytime you want.
Yeah, that's true. And you get right out of bed and do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how has the solo thing evolved since you first started doing it?
I mean, there's like a sound that I'm still going for.
Yeah.
You know? Like, when I went to Mills, I got really into Elion Radigue,
uh-huh,
Marianne Amiche, and James Fay.
Uh-huh. He teaches at Mills.
Yeah.
Yeah.
James is great.
Yeah.
And I just got into like wall of sound stuff. Like I love that. Just
right.
That's when and I'm still working on doing that with an acoustic clarinet.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
That's my vibe. I'm getting closer and closer because I'm not trying to do what Roscoe does. I'm not trying to do, you know, like that's his shit. And I'm trying to do what I'm trying to do. And yeah, I just want to be able to sustain a dense timbre that has a lot of activity and pitch material in it.
Uh-huh.
So it demands like circular breathing and stuff like that.
Yeah. And you've never incorporated any kind of electronics into it?
Well, the record I did, OBF 14,
uh-huh,
that was amplified.
Right, right. But just amplified. You weren't using any, like, auxiliary materials to alter the sound.
There was a delay pedal.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah. Delay and clarinet's a nice combination.
It is.
It's a really nice combination.
Yeah.
I use it a little too much.
But with that one, I had, like, this full stack I had built.
Uh-huh.
And I recorded it in a chapel in, like, the summer of 2014 at the Old Baptist Foundation Hall, which is on the SIU campus.
Uh-huh.
And I had, they would leave it unlocked. And you
wait,
know.
So did they know that you were doing that, or you, like, broke it?
No, I would just go in there, and security, when they come through at midnight to lock up the building, and I would just, I'd have to be in there before midnight, because I always work at night.
Yeah.
But, you know, the security, they just kind of, like, look into the hall, and they see somebody with a clarinet, and they think, like, big deal.
It's a white guy with a clarinet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except, you know, it was, like, sun-level output.
Yeah.
And I was playing clarinet into a floor tom.
Uh-huh.
Which then gets this...
Yeah, I know that sound.
And then I just had it through the full stack.
And you recorded it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With, like, a Zoom. Yeah, it's been an uphill thing, you know? But hopefully it'll just keep getting easier.
I doubt it.
Yeah, you're
That's
right.
not the idea. The idea is for it to get harder.
Yes, stay ignorant. Yeah.
Right on. And you have a lot of tours coming up? You tour a lot.
Yeah, I mean, things are still happening. Wayzongle finished a record, and all the members of that band are doing stuff, so we're, like, not really doing anything right now.
Yeah.
Like, bass, Pat Keen just finished a solo record. Rob's working on a solo record. Phil is playing in Vandermark's new band.
Oh, cool.
So it's, like, everybody's staying busy, so... And we've been touring a lot the past year, so we're like, all right, let's take a breather.
And chill for a minute, yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm going to China to do a residency.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Where in China and...
Lijiang.
What's the residency?
It's like... It was curated by a cello player in the Bay Area, Crystal Piscucci.
Okay.
And... She just asked me, she was like, you want to come to rural China and just work on music? And it's commissioned. So I could have gone for 3 months, but my dog's like 13.
Yeah.
So I chose to just go for a month.
When is that?
Like July 21st to August 21st.
And so you're just going to go to rural China, play the clarinet.
I'm going to play the clarinet. I'm going to come back. And then I have like a tour in September, like West Coast, pretty much all California. And then I'm going to go to Chicago and do some stuff in October, but then I might be going to Iceland for a little bit. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Just keep doing stuff.
It's good shit.
But if I move out of California, it'll be like in the fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I'm glad you came over, dude.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. That was John McCowan. He is a pretty exceptional musician, and I'm glad to start getting to know him. I expect we'll be in touch. I expect we'll do some stuff in the future. If you enjoyed that conversation, if you're enjoying this music, please go to johnmccowan.com. Like I said, he's a special guy. johnmccowan.com. That's it. I hope you guys are all doing well. Talk to you next week. Bye.